When I was in elementary school, when I was in third grade, I loved dinosaurs. I had a little playset. Of course, it had cavemen and it had dinosaurs, which we know is not true. But I used to go into school every morning and flip open my desk and line my desk with little dinosaur erasers. And, you know, I was into it for a while. But like most people, I grew out of dinosaurs. And what I never grew out of was science, being a curious person, wanting to ask questions, and then wanting to be the one to find the answers myself. And being outside and just feeling a connection to nature and loving nature. And those two concepts of curiosity and adventure kind of drove me back into science. But my return to paleontology was kind of random. I got a book one year from my mother for Christmas about Lucy, which is a fossil from human ancestry. And I read it from cover to cover, and I was completely fascinated. And I went to my library in a small town in New York where I grew up, and I took out every book there was on human evolution and fossils and read everything I could and was totally hooked from then on out. If you think about a dinosaur, you're probably going to think about a dinosaur that's from the late Jurassic or the late Cretaceous. So either about 150 million years old or right at the end when most dinosaurs went extinct about 65 million years ago. So these are guys like Triceratops, Stegosaurus, the old dinosaur we used to call Brontosaurus, that's now Apatosaurus, and T-Rex, right? Some of the most famous dinosaurs. Well, the interesting thing is that although we know a lot about those time periods when dinosaurs lived in North America, we don't know a lot about the dinosaurs that lived in between those time periods. So what we did is we launched an expedition to an area in the western U.S. to specifically target dinosaurs that lived right in the middle of that gap of our understanding of dinosaur evolution. And those were dinosaurs that lived about 100 million years ago. Well, a lot of this is going out west and looking for the dinosaurs that are the easiest to find, right? Because the first thing you want to do when you want to go discover something is go to the places where you know you're going to have the best results. And so dinosaur hunters have been going out since before the Civil War to the American West, digging up dinosaurs for museums and exhibits, and they went to the easiest places to go. And so those were the areas of the late Jurassic and the late Cretaceous. But now we've sort of gotten a lot of information about those areas, and we're interested in learning all we can about areas where dinosaurs aren't as common. And so we're sort of targeting areas that are a little more difficult to work, where dinosaurs are a little rarer, or maybe they're not as complete. But they still give us a lot of really important information. Sea urchin is an animal I actually found the very first year we started this project, back in 2008. And it was one of those great moments where you're trekking along the side of a hill and suddenly there's bone fragments popping out of the side of the hill, because that's how we find dinosaurs. It isn't high tech. It's eyes on the ground. We're just out walking around looking for bone that's actually already degrading on the surface, where these skeletons are already breaking apart. And I was walking along the side of a hill and I saw these little fragments of black bone poking out of the side of the hill, and I stopped to pick it up, and we knew it was something significant right away, because these theropod dinosaurs have very thin-walled bones, just like birds are living theropod dinosaurs or these predatory dinosaurs, and they have very thin bones as well. So even when we found fragments of this animal, we knew right away we had something big, something new, and something really important. We didn't find a ton of the animal. So like I said, these are not places where you're going to go and generally find a whole skeleton. It's much more difficult. But we found portions of its pelvis and its hind leg and its tail and its back and some teeth. Some of this we know very well. The size of the animal, for instance, is something we've got a pretty good handle on. So the hind leg, the shape and the size of the hind leg is a really good indicator of the size of the animal, because these animals only walk on their hind legs. So that kind of thing, when it comes to the size of the animal and what it looked like in general terms, we know a lot. Because we don't have a skull, for example, we have no certainty about what the skull of this animal would look like. What we have to do in that instance is we look on the family tree once we figure out who its closest relatives are, and we have to make a best scientific guess that it looked similar to those things it's most closely related to. But until we find more, we won't know for certain exactly what, say, the skull of this animal looked like. So one of the important things about sea urchin is its sheer size. So this animal was one of the top three predators in terms of its size that ever roamed North America. T-Rex is still the reigning champion, as far as we can still tell, still the biggest so far predator that's ever walked North America. And then Acrocanthosaurus, which we have in our dome down in the Museum of Natural Sciences that you can come visit, which is an incredible specimen, reigns in at number two. Sea otch is right now number three, but the interesting thing is that the skeleton we found was a juvenile and still had a lot of growing to do, and so we're estimating it probably would have been about the size of Acrocanthosaurus. So one of the top two largest predators ever to have lived here in North America. Sea otch is from a completely different group of predators than tyrannosaurs are. Tyrannosaurs like T-Rex. The interesting thing is, though, if you want to be a giant predatory dinosaur, there's pretty much one good way to do it. And so what you see through time is you see different groups of animals that evolve to look the same because that structure of their bodies is really good for being a giant predator. And so they looked a lot like tyrannosaurs, but they were not closely related at all. It's a surprising thing about evolution, but what works, works. And when you become an animal that feeds in the same way or lives in the same ecosystem, you tend to evolve structures that are good at those functions. And so you end up looking more similar than you do dissimilar. People probably think it's so much fun to name a dinosaur, but everyone I know gets kind of freaked out when it's time to name the dinosaur because you want to pick something that resonates with the public, but, you know, you recognize there's going to be a lot of criticism or praise depending on what you choose. We named Sea Otch. We wanted to pay homage to local legends in the area where Sea Otch was found. So this was an ancient land where the Ute tribal nation lived. And we wanted to choose something that sort of reflected that heritage. So we ended up choosing a name from one of their legends about a monster that would sneak into town at night and eat children. And it was, so Sea Otch, it was the man-eating monster. And we thought that was a great name, but then when it hit the press, we realized that people were confusing the fact that we'd given it a man-eating monster with this concept of dinosaurs and men living together. And so you never really know how these are going to play out in the beginning. So Meeker Aurum was a name that I chose as the species name to honor the Meeker family. And the Meeker family both came out to the field with us on the year we made the discovery, but also sponsored a scientist position at the Field Museum where I was doing my work. And so their contribution to helping young scientists advance their careers and get the education they need to do a good job is why we chose to honor them. Oh, this project was and is run by myself and a very good colleague of mine at the Field Museum, Pete Bakovicki, who's the curator of dinosaurs there. And I was his postdoctoral fellow, which is just a scientist who's completed their PhD but hasn't gone on to a permanent position yet. And we were working together. We launched this project together. And now both of our institutions go out there every year and collect. So the Field Museum goes out and collects in the same beds that we're collecting, and we keep the partnership going. We don't just go out and dig up a dinosaur and bring it home. We have to collect all the data that stays with that specimen in the museum records, and we have to think about the future. So even if we don't have a way of using the data now, because once we dig it up, whatever data we didn't collect is lost, we have to try and think ahead, you know, in 100 years, what kind of information would somebody want about the specimen? And we have to try and collect all of that data at the time we collect the specimen. So this ecosystem was a time when a seaway was moving across the center of North America. It's a really cool time period. We talk a lot about global warming and rising sea level today. One of the fascinating things about being a paleontologist is we get to actually study when the Earth looked like that in the past. So sometimes I think we think we have no idea where we're going in the world. These are all new changes for us. Well, they're changes for us as human species, but in the history of life, we've experienced all of these things before. And so the paleontological record, the fossil record, is really great for providing us evidence of actually how these things happen. In the Cretaceous period, we had a warming planet, similar to the global warming we're experiencing today. Sea level was rising. And as a result, we had a seaway that actually broke North America into a series of islands. And so when Sea Otch was living, it was sort of the beginning of this seaway coming in and splitting North America. So it would have been pretty close to the sea. actually, even though he's out in Utah today in the middle of a desert, was a very lush ecosystem. There were turtles everywhere, crocodiles, mammals, a whole variety of dinosaurs, and of course, even dinosaurs flying in the air with birds. We have small-bodied mammals. They looked a lot kind of like modern rodents do. They were really living in the shadow of the dinosaurs at this time, but very successful, obviously did a good job surviving the extinction event that followed, and then colonizing the planet as the top predators themselves later on. So the only other dinosaur that's been named from this ecosystem in the past is an animal called Eolambia, and this is a duckbill dinosaur, giant duckbill dinosaur. So there's plenty of food around for sea otter to hunt. But we know there's a whole variety of other dinosaurs, and we just haven't found enough of their skeletons to be able to describe them yet. We have, as part of this project, already found at least two new species of dinosaurs that we have enough of the skeleton now to be able to name. So in the next 2 years, 3 years, we're going to be kind of unrolling the different players in Sea Otter's ecosystem. The dinosaurs that we're finding that lived alongside of Sea Otter were also really big. Some of them, some of the largest examples we have on the continent also. So we're wondering why. Why were the animals that lived in this particular ecosystem so large at this time? We have some more plant eaters. We have some smaller bodied plant eaters. And we have a more feathered dinosaurs. So Sea Otter may or may not have been a feathered animal. Probably if it was, it had sort of a downy feather, similar to what you'd find in your pillow or your sofa, but not a real complex, stiff feather. But then we have some other groups of feathered dinosaurs that would have had more complex feathers, perhaps tail fans or wings. And so we have some examples of those, which should be really cool. And the other thing is the animals in this ecosystem are really big. And we don't know why, but we're getting some of the largest animals we've ever found.